Accession number 27226, Reel 2.
Lionel Hook, Reel 2. So you'd had your medical, and obviously there was the problem with your hernia.
Yeah.
Do you have any memories, though, of that period while you were waiting to go into the Fleet Air Arm and have your hospital treatment? Of the first aspects of the war, really?
Yes, I do. Well, the first thing that happened, of course, they dropped bombs in Bridlington, because Flamborough Head was the focal point for coming into the East Yorkshire. And Bridlington was well and truly bombed. And the first George Cross, I think, came to a railwayman in Bridlington as a result of that. And we were bombed consistently throughout the war. When they're going, when somebody chickened out, or when they're going back and then they left over, they thought, give them to Brid. And it was... at the early stages, not a lot that I can remember anyway. I was travelling up and down to Beverley, and that didn't seem to pose any problem. Everything seemed to be quite normal.
Because there wasn't much happening really in what was the kind of your feeling to that?
The phony war, wasn't it, really? But they were always coming over to Bridlington, purely and simply if they went recce or anything like that. Or when the large raid started, they came over en masse. But I don't remember much about that. I know we used to go under the stairs when they were coming over in the house, but it's not really interesting. I suppose it's difficult to describe that gap. There's a mental gap there, really. I was working. I had no friends because all my friends had gone off anyway. Bridlington became more or less desolate. All my school pals were in the Green Howards, number 7th Battalion Green Howards, and Gordon Dick was in the Fleet Air Arm. There were three or four people from Bridlington went to the Fleet Air Arm, but mainly they went into the army, I think. They followed the Green Howards because that was the 7th Battalion Green Howards of their regiment, and then became mechanised later on. So, of course, we had quite a few in the Navy proper, but not the Fleet Air Arm. And they were doing, the two people, I think, Miles Mackerith and, what's the other lad, just died. They were doing runs with MGBs to Sweden to get, we imported stuff from Germany, you know that, don't you? Did you not know that? Have nobody ever told you? We were buying stuff from Germany, and we were selling stuff to Germany from ICI. And it was all going through these people. This is a story in itself. They set off in MGBs, and I relate to this when I got to the situation where I had to fill aircraft myself from 5-gallon flimsies. They set off to go to Sweden, Malmö, I think it was. Was it Malmö? In MGBs, and in order to have enough petrol to get there, the decks were stacked with 5-gallon flimsies. And the moment they set off, they had three Packard Merlins inside, just galloping petrol. They started pouring petrol into the tank to keep it going and get rid of it, because if they got caught in a firefight, one in the cemetery, and the whole bloody thing goes up. And they went all the way there, and then they had to cut and run back again. And people don't know this. And we got ball bearings from a lot of ball bearings from Sweden, a lot of basic chemicals, because ID Farben Industry and ICI were very close together before the war, and obviously what they made there they didn't make here, and vice versa, and it was all going through Sweden. You don't know that. There was quite a regular run all the time. And those lads, both Miles Mackerith and Oh, dear, what do they call him? They're old school pals of mine, anyway. They're a bit older than me. They were in the Royal Yorkshire Yacht Club. And, of course, for Dunkirk, they all went down from Yorkshire with the Yorkshire Yacht Club on that jolly as well.
How is things for civilians? And you said not much was happening, really, at that period, the Phoney War. But was rationing being introduced at that stage?
I can't remember, but we never wanted for food. Mainly because we were in an agrarian community, and my father knew, because of where he was and what he was, he knew all the farmers. So we always had eggs. I think the thing that we were all short of was sugar, probably. Sugar was the thing that... but it was hard. I mean, there weren't all the easy things. We never got bananas. Bananas disappeared completely. When rationing came along, that was hard. And I can remember it when I get back home, you know, that when I was married, that was later on in the war. There were tight rations. It was, you know, there's no joy in food, that's for sure.
And what about things like restrictions on movement? Was there restrictions on movement at Bridlington? Or?
Oh, yeah. All the restriction to the beaches, we didn't go on the beaches anymore. We used to go wildfowling after the war, and before the war we always used the beaches, but the beaches were to some extent limited, but not in that early stage. They were later on, because my brother was on the beach when he had his accident. And it was right down the beach at Barmston, so that part of the beach was open to people. It wasn't defended. But later on, certainly down in the Ipswich, where I was, Ipswich, the beaches and the coastline was very, very heavily defended. When did I finish? August 40, in January 40, in 41, all the coastline where there was a chance of landing, the boys that went in the Navy as ODs were kept back to go there for a short period of time.
And I'm thinking again of the Phoney War period. Was it thought that gas would be a big threat at that period?
It was obviously considered a threat because everyone had a gas mask, but that's as far as it went. That's as far as it went.
Would you carry that gas mask with you everywhere?
Oh, yeah. You kept it all the time in a box with a string. Oh, yes. Yes, all the time. But everybody walked around with a gas mask. Everybody.
So your call-up came in August?
August.
Of 1940?
1940.
How did that arrive? What was the...
A letter. A brown envelope. Came through the door. I can't remember how I got down there, but I must have had a railway warrant. Appointed to HMS Ganges at Shotley, down the coast, as an OD. Well, that was a revelation. Have you had anybody tell you about Ganges? Yeah.
Well, you tell me... How you know, obviously, step by step, how you arrived. What was the first thing that happened as you arrived at Ganges?
Well, now we arrived there as civilians with clothes. I don't know what I had, but I know that we were inducted. We went in, and we were doled out with a kit bag, a hammock. All our clothes were taken. Well, there was the night when we got all our clothes and everything, because we changed the clothes. And that was interesting, really. It's just, let me think about that one a little bit, because I remember we arrived, and we were a group of people arriving, about 60 of us, all sorts of shapes and sizes, from all over England. And... we went into the... We were shepherded around. I can't think where we were shepherded. That's a funny place anyway. But we went in, and first of all, the names were put on a rubber stamp, and everything was rubber stamped. And then they started doling out the kit for us, boots and collars and ties and hats and all the bits and pieces, and a cat badge, HMS with no Ganges on it. And then we were sent off to pack up all our gear into the hut. Thinks. I don't know when we were injected first, whether it must have been after we were in uniform. So we went into the place and we dressed up in our uniform, packed up our clothes to go home. That one thing. I couldn't care the monkeys. I was so glad to be doing something, you know. But some of the blokes were a little bit weird. And they were a mixed bag. There were EastEnders. There was a Newcastle, a Geordie from a particular short squat Geordie that I knew. He was my minder later on. But I'll tell you about that in just the induction period. And first of all, I suppose after the induction, we changed into uniform. We then had to find ways and means of feeding ourselves. Have you been through this exercise anyway? No. Oh, well, life as an OD was different from the Fleet Air Arm. The Fleet Air Arm boys went in. When I went into Vincent, I was then a seaman, and I was a leading seaman when all the boys there were ODs. Well, they were leading airmen then, weren't they, or something? They made it leading airmen afterwards, something, it doesn't matter. But, so, we were then put into... a class. We went through the inoculation thing, which was... That in itself was quite horrendous, because of 60 people, there would be 10 of them got vaccinia, for a start. And some of the vaccinia was pretty horrible. And of those 60 people going down the line, at least 5 of them, when they saw a needle going into their arms, they fainted. Quite incredible, really. But you got used to that sort of thing. It's a question of attitude, really. I mean, people's attitudes, as opposed to the category of person you're dealing with. The grammar school boys, for want of categorising them, they just said, well, they're going to stick a needle in my arm, stick a needle in my arm, bugger it, you know. And that was it. But the others, they were... It was a different world for them, completely and utterly. Not that it wasn't anything that was different for us, but they were chucked together in a mixed bag of people, suddenly realizing they had to live together. And somebody had to go and fetch the food, and it was rationed. So the thing was organized into groups, were divided into 4 course leaders and everything else. And... one of the things I remember well about that was that that was animal existence, because you looked after yourself. If you didn't look after yourself, then you were down at the bottom of the heap, especially with food. And butter, when the butter came in for 60 people, it was a pound slab of butter. And if you didn't get your slice quick, you lost a finger, you know, that sort of thing. It was, you know, animals, really. But it got it organised, and... I'm sorry to say this, and it's ego, but our course was slightly different. But we're one of a group of courses at Ganges. We had to wash our own clothes. Some blokes had never used soap before, you know. You could buy things from the slops to supplement your lifestyle. You could go to the NAFI and get the bits and pieces afterwards, but there was a basic ration. You had to be up at 6 o'clock in the morning when it was bloody dark, and you're marching round from 6 till 12. I mean, if you weren't fit then, by the time you finished that course at Ganges, you were fit. Every day at 12 o'clock, and I've gone on a little bit from part one. We finished marching. We're marching up and down. It's August time. You can imagine we're all sweaty, and it was hard work. And at 12 o'clock, the lads who were to go to the galley to get the food were sent off. 4 people get the grub. The others had to go Hannister bathe in the swimming pool. Now, 60 people. How many of those people ever swam at that time of How many people had ever been in a swimming pool or in a swimming bath out of 60 people? If there was 10, you're moving fast. They said, this is what they did with these blokes. We went along to the bath at 12 o'clock, and it's the classic Navy way of doing things. At least if the buggers don't wash themselves, they get washed once a day. Into the place, stripped off, and you've heard of the little swimming things that they had, a piece of cloth with two strings on it. And the first time, I'm embarrassed, you know, to tie the straps off. And into the pond. And they would just jump in, regardless, at one side, only one width of the bath, regardless of whether the deep end or the other end, to get to the other side. That's the first experience they'd ever had of being in wet water. And there's a PO at the other side. Anybody's drowning, they just put a stick across and pull them back across. And before they finished the course, they could all swim. They had to, because they had to pass a test in the water with a female jacket on in water, say, for 5 minutes.
I take it you could swim coming from Bridlington.
Strangely enough, only just. That's a fair question, because we used to go to the swimming baths at school, because that was all we had. But people never seem to learn to swim in the sea for some reason. I went into the sea, but I wasn't a very good swimmer then, that I can remember. Though I see, there's no reason to go. You went into the water. You probably swam around a little bit in the sand on the beach and everything else, but you never got into deep water doing long, hard swimming. You know what I mean? It was the difference. You fell in the harbour, okay, you swam around, but there was a boat nearby, and you grabbed hold of the boat and got in the boat, and somebody pulled you out and dragged you off.
You described very well there, obviously, the different mix of people that you would get and the eating arrangements. What was your accommodation like? Can you describe that to me?
Yes, we're all in... we were double bunked, weren't we? We're in huts, anyway. The huts were one big room with two rooms at the end where one instructor stayed. There was a leaning hand that looked after us. And we had two recalled POs, who PO instructors, to teach us bends and hitches and all aspects of Navy, deck work and that sort of thing. Interesting point that at Ganges, they had, for gun drill, they had gun breeches, 18-inch gun breeches there, which we did gun, but there weren't any 18-inch guns in the Navy. We were bombed, of course. We had an incident where early introduction to death and disaster, when an aircraft came over, obviously in dire straits, really, and he landed alongside the huts on the side of Ganges. I can't remember. There was a lot of field or ponds around it, and they smashed, and the ordinary seaman who just joined was sent to bring the body back and get everything, bits and pieces, and they were put in a room alongside one of the huts, and you could look inside and see them, the bits of arms and legs all over the place. That was the first introduction to sort of the fact that people did get killed and they were chopped up a little bit. Sort of an indication of what the war was like.
You mentioned instruction there, and you had a couple of POs instructing you. Can you give me the kind of sequence of instruction of how they started to teach the recruits about naval life? And
well, first of all, the physical aspects of the Navy were brought to fore by making you march and run and everywhere else where you did. We had the Ganges mast, which is about 200 foot high, I think. It's the tallest mast there ever was anyway. And one part of the exercise, but not initially, it was to go round the mast, up the mast, and round the outside, up the top, up the knot. And in the days when it was a boys' training place, the boys, you'd go up to the top and stand on the button on the top. But to get... I shinned up the mast, but I never got onto the button. But there was a rope ladder going halfway up the mast, and then you grab them and go up that bit. But that was hairy. Strangely enough, all pilots have got vertigo. Did you know that? And you find out when you try and climb a bloody mast before you've even been a pilot. Because you tend to, when you're going up, you've got to rely on your... what I used to do... I go back in time and talk about that. Go back. When I was a boy, one thing we used to do, because my father knew Lengs, who used to collect seabirds' eggs, and I was leapt over the side on the thing to collect seabirds' eggs on a piece of string, you know, on a rope. And it never bothered me on the end of the rope. No problem at all. But yet, even to this day, I can't go to the edge of a cliff without feeling pretty bloody horrible, you know? And go to the, you know, these big slides you have in the things. Well, up the steps to the top and go down. When you get to the top, it's an awful feeling. So that's dealing with vertigo and the mast at Ganges.
Were you made to climb the mast?
Oh yes.
As part of the training.
Yes, all the boys had to climb the mast, and it was very hard for some of them. They were frightened to death. Going, if you fell off, you know, there was a big net underneath. But the net was supported by a lot of poles sticking up in the net, and if you didn't hit the net and hit the pole, you weren't very well, to say the least.
Was there anybody who refused to go up the mast at all in your time there?
Not that I can know of. The POs were... They were peacetime Navy POs. They were hard men, no question. But they were also reasonably tolerant. And we had a good old McKinnon. They had a pub on the great on the North Road somewhere, and he was quite good. They taught us bends and hitches, deck work, anchors and cables, flags. We got a copy of the seamanship manual, and that was our sort of instruction really in practical seamanship, knots and splices, boat pulling, of course. And that was the first thing that happened to me. I went to Ganges. I just had a hernia operation. And have you ever been in a cutter? It's a big boat. And the sweeps are about 15 foot. They're longer than this room wide. And you have to pull those. And you were doing pulling as well.
Where would you do that?
In the Orwell, in Ipswich, the river going up and down there.
How would they instruct you in that? Would you have a certain distance to cover, or would you do it?
No, you're in a cutter. You'd be with a group of people. There'd be four, and you'd be instructed in pulling and everything. It's physical exercise anyway, and going alongside, how to get alongside, because in those days they still used cutters to get alongside, so everybody had to. If you lift a 15-foot buddy oar that way, you know, to go alongside, up and alongside, that was sailing, seamanship generally.
You mentioned being instructed on knots and splices. How did they do that?
Oh, that was just a school, that was schoolroom stuff with ropes and everything else, and splicing, how to splice, and rope manage generally. They didn't teach anybody any wire splicing, but we got a knife to do it with. You know, that was part of the issue. They taught us a very interesting exercise was, if you were a seaman, of course, one of the jobs was to soundings when you're going inshore. You never heard this one before? No. Well... What they call them, the chains, don't they? You go into the chains to take a depth with a weight on, and you want to find the nature of the bottom. They put tallow in the bottom, so you go to the bottom and it comes up with sand or gravel or something on the bottom, you know what it is. And this thing is a 7-pound weight, like this, on the end of a piece of string, a piece of rope or tarry band, call it what you like. And you've got to throw that forward. Are you still with me? And you're up on a high platform. The height of this house off the ground. Have the corner there, take the corner. Can you just pull sideways? Can you see there to that house there?
You might talk.
Pardon?
Yeah. It'll be how
about 20 foot high, and you're standing
in the chains with a 7-pound weight at the end of a piece of rope. And of course, it's no good just dropping in the water if the boat's underway, because the thing goes backwards. So you've got to float as far forward as you can. And in order to throw it a long way, you swing it over your head. Have you ever thought of swinging a 20-foot piece of rope with 7-pound weight at the end? It goes all the way around and gets to the top and decides not to go any further, and it comes down. And where's it going to go? It's gone to you. It's bloody hairy, I'll tell you. I've never heard anybody think of it that way at all. But that's a memorable thing that you remember. Other aspects, of course, was life generally in the place. We had a sort of social life because our rennery nearby, and the story's in the book there. But we were organised crew. Cumberland, I think, Rugby International. We had two actors there. We had about 4 or 5 grammar school boys who, played rugby and that sort of thing. I played hockey as well, which is unusual. In Bridlington, we used to go on the beach every Sunday with the Bridlington crowd, and about 36 or 40 people with hockey sticks. And we divided into two and played hockey on the beach until 12 o'clock. And when I went into the Navy, this was the game that they played. And I could play hockey, and I got involved in that as well. But there was a rennery. We had our own officer, a man called Warrender, who was in. He was one of the actors in Scott of the Antarctic, the film. He was our and the rennery.
Well, we were an organised crowd. To give you some idea. We're a group of people all together with requirements of living really in a naval environment. Now, these are the nasty stories. First of all, when you join the Navy, you've got a ration of tobacco, or you could have a rum ration. You either took it or you got threepence a day for rum. I took the threepence, took the money. As far as tobacco is concerned, you've got cigarettes, or leaf tobacco, or ordinary tobacco. The petty officers were retired, and they were called back, and they weren't really interested in the Navy, they were interested in living. All the people who didn't want cigarettes, the POs purchased the tobacco from the boys, and all that tobacco went ashore in the PO's laundry wagon, and they sold it ashore. The POs, being old Navy POs, taught two or three of us how to make plug tobacco with leaf. And we used to make plug tobacco. And that's quite interesting, because you really take the leaf and put a tot of rum in it and then roll it in canvas and then pull it tight and compress it, purely and simply by the effect of the rope on it. And my grandfather died smoking the bloody stuff. He thought it was the best thing since sliced bread, or best thing since tobacco. But that was one of the things that happened. But the net result was that the relationship at that time between the POs and the troops themselves was not a naval relationship, because they were civilians that had come back, retired, and they were not best pleased, but they had the job to do. And so we were a little bit worldly wise, if you can be at 18, 19 or 21. I was 21, I was then. So, because the POs knew that we knew where the tobacco was going, and that if they were too hard on us, we could be too hard on them. And we used that to our advantage, to the extent that the boys worked hard with them, because they didn't work hard at us. Do you see what I mean?